This is Scenic Roots. I'm Ray Bassett. Thanks for joining us. Rosanna Hughes covers crime, the courts, and breaking news in our area for the Chattanooga Times Free Press. And lately, there has been a lot to cover on that beat, from investigations of law enforcement misconduct, to the aftermath of the killing of George Floyd while in police custody in Minneapolis, to the protests here in Chattanooga, and more. Last week, we had a conversation beyond the headlines.
Rosanna, thanks for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
Tell us more about your beat at the Times Free Press.
I cover general crime. I cover policing and also the court system here, mostly on the criminal side, although I do cover a few of the civil cases, especially civil rights cases against police departments and cities.
And how long have you been on this beat?
Specifically covering crime, probably about 2 years now. I've been with the Times Free Press for 3.5 years now, I think.
What drew you to the crime beat?
Oh, I grew up watching stuff like 48 Hours and Dateline and stuff. So it's kind of my dream job. There was just an opening and I kind of fell right into the beat. I was already covering some of the on-the-ground work of like when a shooting happened. So it kind of came naturally, I guess. Sometimes I do feel like I am on call a lot whenever there's a shooting or a major accident or crash, whether intentional or unintentional. I am often the one who goes out there to the scenes and interviews the people out there, talks to the police, just get what we can. A lot of times we don't have a lot of information up front because that has to play out through the court system, but just capturing the human moments is really important.
What's something that most people here might not realize about law enforcement, about the criminal justice system? Because there's the 48 hours version of the story, and then there's what you see out there on the beat.
There's a lot of nuance to every story. And it's a lot of times, even, you know, in TV shows or TV news or even in print, you know, we have a little bit more flexibility because we don't have to fit everything into, you know, a certain amount of time. But regardless, you know, these cases, there's so much on either side, and you don't always see that in a condensed version in a newspaper or on the TV news. But I guess it's a combination of that and maybe not always understanding the steps and procedures to how the justice system works. You have to meet certain thresholds, I guess, in order to get a conviction or to be able to charge something, I mean, someone with a certain crime.
I noticed on your Twitter feed, you highlighted a posting from Tennessee Open Government of a ProPublica story, 5 ways to start holding your department accountable when it comes to public records. Why is that so important?
Making a habit out of requesting these records can be hugely important because a lot of times that's where stories are. For example, I do my best to make a habit out of requesting closed internal affairs investigations and what their disposition was. So by just keeping tabs on that, you can kind of, maybe there's an officer who regularly gets complaints, or maybe there is a certain complaint that is kind of spiking. You can dig down into what the reason behind that is. Maybe the officer just has a string of bad luck, or maybe he is a problem. Or maybe there's a larger problem, a training problem. By requesting those records, that's how you can get to the bottom of what actually is going on big picture in these different law enforcement agencies. That's just one part of it, though, but also understanding how policing works and how laws governing their conduct work is also huge. And an example that I gave on my Twitter was, I did a story on the Saudi Daisy Police Department, and something that didn't make it into the story because I ultimately ended up getting a clarification and didn't have to fact check this voice in the story. But for example, the story was about some Saudi Daisy police officers shot and killed an elderly man. And there's a lot of nuance to it, so I'm not going to get into that, but that's the gist of it. Usually in larger departments, when something like that happens, the officers are put on administrative leave and an internal investigation is started that works parallel to the criminal investigation, although the internal investigation sometimes has to be basically put on hold while the criminal investigation takes precedent. So I asked first whether these officers were put on administrative leave and if an internal investigation had taken place. And the city attorney told me that, yes, an internal investigation had taken place and that the sheriff's office had conducted that internal investigation. But because I have this background of covering law enforcement and I have covered previous cases of police shootings and I have an idea of how the process works, I knew that that didn't sound very accurate. So I went to the sheriff's office and I asked them, was the sheriff's office tasked with conducting an internal affairs investigation for Saudi Daisy Police Department? And that was not the case. Essentially, for the sheriff's office to conduct an internal affairs investigation, they have to be requested specifically by the chief of police or by the city manager, and that didn't happen. So if I didn't have that background of how these processes work, I would have just quoted the city attorney as saying that, yes, an internal affairs investigation did take place, which wasn't completely accurate. In the end, the sheriff's office did conduct the investigation, which was just a fact-finding mission for the district attorney. The purpose of that investigation was to determine whether there was probable cause that a crime had occurred, not whether the department's internal policies had been violated. It was accurate in that the investigation was conducted by the sheriff's office, but it was not accurate in that an internal investigation took place. So understanding that is why I was able to accurately say that based on the sheriff's office investigation, it was determined that the shooting was justified, and therefore an internal investigation wasn't deemed necessary. So just a little tiny nuance in there, but accuracy matters when you're talking about law enforcement.
When it comes to making changes in law enforcement, whether it's what the activists are demanding and the language they're using, or it's criminal justice experts who have studied departments across the country for years. Whatever changes come long-term after an event such as the death of George Floyd, these changes tend to take a long time and they tend to be very intricate because there are a lot of moving parts behind the scenes that most of us are not aware of.
Whatever approach people have, it's going to take some time. It's going to have to go through city or county governments. They're going to have to approve these things, and then it'll trickle down to individual agencies. So it's not something that's going to happen overnight. I know that a lot of us wish that it could, but these agencies and departments and laws and procedures and policies have been in place for decades. And it's not just going to be a revamp policy by the book revolution. It's going to take a lot of cultural and societal change, and that in and of itself will take a very long time. Hopefully sooner than later, but I think the country right now is in an interesting place, and I think that ultimately we as a country are making some progress.
All right. We'll be following. Rosanna, thanks so much.
Thank you for having me.
Townsend Atelier here in Chattanooga is partnering with the Tennessee River Gorge Trust to celebrate the power of the small things that live and thrive in the gorge. 8 visual artists in this area have created artwork that will be on view tomorrow in a live stream event, and the proceeds from the event will benefit the gorge. I spoke with Peggy Townsend of Townsend Atelier and Alicia Hickson with the Trust.
Peggy, Alicia, thanks for joining us.
Thank you.
Thanks for having us.
This is a virtual event, but it is for something grand in nature.
Absolutely. We have done this event for years, and it's always in person. But this year, we are mobilizing and moving it virtual, and it's going to be a lot of fun. And it does. It supports the Tennessee River Gorge Trust and the amazing work we're doing to protect and preserve the River Gorge.
And the partnership with Townsend Atelier and the artists. Peggy, tell us more about that. The theme is the power of small.
Right. The theme is the power of small. And this is the second year that we have done this form of the partnership. We've worked with the Gorge in the past with their fundraiser, Another Gorgeous Evening, and involved artists in that. But last year, we started with a whole new format that worked really well, which was we kind of curated and pre-selected 8 artists that are affiliated with us. They're some of the best artists in Chattanooga, we've asked them to create artwork based on a theme. So last year's theme was the essence of place. So we asked them to sort of capture the essence of the gorge. And that could mean anything from a big landscape to something smaller. But this year's theme, we gave them the theme of the power of small. So they've all been asked to think about something that is small but powerful, that lives and thrives in the gorge, whether it's powerful from an ecological standpoint or from a beauty aspect. Got everything from flora to fauna, got sculpture as well as painting and collage in the show. So these eight artists have these works, and they'll be previewed and available for purchase.
Tell us about access to the gorge at this time.
Our campsites and our trails are open for public use. We encourage everybody to follow all the CDC guidelines, social distancing, and to pick up after themselves as always. But our Pop Point campsite, our Williams Island campsites are open. We have closed some of the Williams Island campsites. Not all of them are open, just to ensure proper social distancing. And our trails, the Ritchie Hollow and the Pop Point Nature Loop Trail, are open. And you can view all the information about those, as well as reserve the campsites at trgt.org.
And then, Peggy, how is the Atelier operating at this time with businesses reopening?
We have been officially closed since March. We canceled all of our workshops, all of our summer camps, which is a huge thing for us. So we've kind of been dormant, except we have had a few classes online if the instructor is comfortable doing it. Not every instructor is willing or able to do that. And then we've also been doing curbside pickup and shipping for art materials. So we're here most every day to answer phone calls and fulfill orders, but we probably won't really resume classes full force until fall. I have a couple of classes in the summer that we're not canceling, but we've reduced the registration to 8 students, and we'll have masks and we'll be appropriately distanced and all of those guidelines. So we operated one class this weekend like that, and it went really well, but we are requiring that everybody kind of take those measures to participate.
And what's it been like for the artists to participate in this partnership this time around with the Tennessee River Gorge Trust?
When we signed them up, this was pre-COVID. So, you know, they were just anticipating another theme to get excited about. They made all the work anticipating that it would be here at Townsend Atelier with a big preview party. And then we had to kind of shift things. So I don't know that it was any different when they were creating the work, but certainly they've all had to prepare a video that's pre-recorded that'll be put up during the evening. So they'll get to meet the artists virtually, and the artists are talking about their work. So they've had to do a few things. Two of the artists, Holly Chastain, who's a collage artist, and Amanda Brazier, who makes her own pigment from earth that she's harvested from the area, both of them have agreed to pre-tape a art lesson demo so the attendees can either watch or make along with them. So we've tried to get them to do some extra things that they wouldn't have done for a normal exhibit, but this kind of hit after we were full stride.
And the event is virtual. The art is shared virtually, but there's no substitute for going out there and seeing the gorge in person.
That's absolutely correct. We encourage everybody to get outside. It's a great time to do that. And it's a great way to take a break from your homes that I'm sure we're all going stir crazy in. And I just wanted to add that on Thursday night, we're also the demonstrations. We have Holly and Amanda doing their amazing art demonstrations. But then we also have Chattanooga Whiskey is going to teach you how to make a cocktail. And you're also going to get a Vine Talk, which is a wine demonstration from Athens Distributing. So there's some great little fun demos and educational pieces that are happening that night that kind of make it feel different. And I think that's what's been most exciting for us in planning this, is really trying to figure out how to be engaging and make it exciting and fun for folks to attend.
Even if it's virtual, it's still attending.
Yes.
And where can people go online for more information?
They can visit our website at trgt.org/AGE.
And Peggy, where can folks go online to keep up with the Atelier?
They could go to townsendatelier.com, or they can look at us on Facebook or Instagram. We're pretty active and keep things current on those two platforms.
All right. Peggy, Alicia, thanks so much.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
You're listening to Scenic Roots. More in a moment.
This is Scenic Roots Talking Writing. Good afternoon. I'm Richard Winham. My guest is Rachel Landrum Crumble. Rachel is a poet. She's also a teacher who has, amazingly to me, taught from kindergarten through college level, which when you stop to think about that, you know, at each level, it's almost like starting over, isn't it?
I guess that's where we get back to that process orientation that I mentioned before we came on air, that I'm very process oriented, and so I can be in the moment with whatever group of learners, I guess. Yeah.
Well, that sounds good, but dealing with children of kindergarten age and dealing with college students, some would say it's exactly the same, but truth is, it isn't, is it?
Right. Because, no.
Yeah. Somebody in kindergarten, even though they may behave exactly the same way as people in college, they don't think the same way.
Yeah.
Which do you find more challenging, to teach at college level or to teach at that very young elementary level?
Actually, right now I've been teaching for most of the past 20 years in high school, and that is probably the most challenging because it's talking about the whole person. Oh my gosh, there's so many precious, damaged whole persons that don't feel whole and don't know they can be whole that I deal with every day, that a lot of the teaching is sort of modeling dignifying behaviors for them and speaking into their lives that, hey, you're valuable, I see you, you know, as well as content. So, and I'm kind of an individualizer, so I teach students, not content, according to the student who they are.
I mean, that's the most wonderful gift you can give somebody is to say, I see you.
Yeah. Yes. Yeah, we all need that, don't we? Yeah.
Especially at that age.
Yeah.
Teenagers.
Yeah. So that's really challenging because it was one of those things where I said when I graduated from colleges, I'm never teaching high school with my English degree. And so I taught adjunct in college, and I taught here too for quite a while, and different places in this area at Covenant and Chattanooga State and here, and taught 2 years full time at Cleveland State and 1 year visiting professor at Lee a while back.
As far as your writing, you have been married to my friend Jim.
Yeah.
Jim Crumble, who is, as I've said many times, I just love to listen to him play.
Yeah.
He always seems to be such an intuitive player. No matter who I've watched him play with, and I watched him play in a lot of different situations.
Yeah.
It always feels as if while he's at the center, he never seems to view it that way.
Yeah. Yeah, that's I agree with that insight. Yeah, I appreciate him for those reasons too. Yeah.
You have three children?
Yes.
Two of whom are old enough to live on their own.
Yeah, now three. The caboose left late in life.
Your other
he
son
left
is
at 21.
Oh, your other son's not a teenager sooner. Anymore.
No, he's not. I do have poems in which he's a teenager a little bit ago, but yeah, he's 21 and living with his 30-year-old brother in Brooklyn, New York now. My 30-year-old is a stylist. So he picks out men's wardrobes for photo shoots and videos. And he was just at the Grammys with Roddy Ricch.
Wow.
Yeah. So he's doing
he's
some
responsible
fun stuff.
For the way these people look, huh?
Yeah, yeah.
I hesitate to make any kind of generalizations about your work based on what is effectively a grab bag of your poems that I found in different publications online.
Right, because they're not all online, but yeah, go ahead.
But the impression I have of the ones that I have read is that, well, first of all, obviously your family is very important to you, but they seem to be also what you most write about.
I guess maybe a fourth or a little bit more of my poems end up being about family. I have a lot of love poems.
Some wonderful love
some
poems.
Other ones, yeah.
One that's fairly recent, that's not a love poem, at least I wouldn't describe it that way, is called Courage for a New Year. And I love the two lines, in these early hours, starting over, seems possible.
Would you like me to read that one?
Yes, I would. I like to think that way at the beginning of a new year.
And I did. I wrote it on New Year's Eve last year, not this past, but the previous year, because I have a habit of you know, Jim always, my husband always plays gigs on New Year's Eve.
Oh, right. Yeah, that makes sense. Yeah.
And I love to write in the new year. So get that replenishing alone time by just thinking over the whole year and naming everything I can think of that I'm thankful for. And then moving into goals if I get there. But often I don't get there because I have so many things to be thankful for. So it's a great way to start the year. But this is called Courage for a New Year. It was published in the online journal Sheila Nagig this past year. Courage for a New Year. All familiar things are released of connotation. In these early hours, starting over seems possible. A shoe on the step becomes hopeful, loses its dereliction, was going somewhere all along. Paper clutter on a bedroom shelf vibrates with history. Old photos, proof of a hard-won past, forecast an unexpected, cheery present. The blank page is a blizzard, and on dog sled we course our way through blinding brightness. While the year is young, it seems possible to arrive. We cannot lose our way before we find it.
That's a really cool line. I really like that. And it's so true, isn't it? Why do you want to be a teacher?
Because I'm a learner. So it's definitely the love of learning and the love of process and the need to articulate process that is pretty important to the teaching process. So that part of it felt natural. And of course, there's more freedom in that in college than there is in high school, where there are state standards and pacing guides and things like that. But I think that, you know, no learning can happen without respect. So that safe space is super important, especially because there's so many people who are traumatized. These days, so many students that, at least at the school where I am, that come from trauma and are in the middle of trauma and can barely wrap their brains around learning because of it for various reasons. And so it's like, well, really, you know, they kind of have to be the subject. And I am able to do that since I'm a co-teacher in a classroom, except for some small classes that I also teach. So I can individualize.
Is one of the reasons for the trauma financial challenges?
Yeah, the county I teach in is a county of poverty, and so there's a lot of attendant social issues with that. The same as urban issues, but more rural, some urban. And so, yeah, you know, as I am I'm a Christian, and so my own, the grace that I've received, I give. And, you know, I hear students say, and it makes me cringe, like, if you want respect, you gotta give respect. I'm not going to respect anybody who doesn't respect me. Well, that's so twisted. It's like we each have dignity and worth because God made us. And, you know, who I am is what I'm going to be to somebody. I'm not going to wait and see how they're going to be to me before I act this way to them. But that's just kind of
that's a defense mechanism, isn't
it? Yeah, it is. Yeah.
The reason I brought that up is because you wrote a poem called The Poor.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, I didn't even bring that one, but I'll read it. Yeah. I wrote it.
Because I thought it's a beautiful poem, the way it's expressed.
Yeah. My sort of extended family is New City Fellowship Church, which I've been involved with since I was in college. And it's started out as a ministry to the poor and the Black community in Chattanooga. And I wrote this back then. The poor in the sky. It's raining backwards, always backwards. From where we stand, it is a nightmare. Our tears are the sprinkler system of heaven. The clouds grow lush and green. They tantalize beyond our ability to desire. We stand poor with sand in our shoes and dust in our mouths, holding buckets upside down to catch the rain.
So part of what that poem seems to be saying is that everything's stacked against them.
Right, just that total helplessness and hopelessness.
Something that I'm not sure many of us really understand.
Right. It's just
unless
just
you've
do
truly
this.
Been,
just
you know, in that,
that
place.
Yeah. Yeah, it's poverty of imagination.
I think this is a love poem. This appears to be addressed to a partner. And at one point, it's called Hold the Moon.
Mm.
It's divided by Roman numerals, 1 through 4, rather. And this is Roman numeral 2. You are a house without doors. I am a house without walls. It's raining. Open the window and let me in.
Yeah.
But I love that idea of you are a house without doors. I'm a house without walls. It's as it was with that student you were just talking about. You know, I'm not going to respect somebody who doesn't respect me.
Oh, yeah.
So that's a person, a house without doors. There's no way into that person because they've got these.
That's true. Yeah.
This shell all around them.
Yeah. Yeah, and this poem, Hold the Moon, is a love poem, really, to my husband. And you know how opposites attract, and we need certain things from each other. And I, especially at the beginning of our marriage, didn't have boundaries, very, very healthy boundaries. And he was like a walled city. So, yeah. Do you want me to read this?
Please do. I love this poem. Yeah.
Okay. Thank you. All right. It's called Hold the Moon, and it was in the Stickmin Review a few years ago. You can find it online. Hold the Moon. 1. Wading through the cold current of your silence, I am waist deep, going deeper as I move towards you. Your skin of night is soft and hot, almost against me, but an ice flow breaks loose, pushes me away. For a moment, I forget to breathe. The cold air, dangerous, jagged in my chest. What a pair we are. You fear intimacy. I fear abandonment. Love, think of the continents our blood has traveled to bring us here. 2. You are a house without doors. I am a house without walls. It is raining. Open the window and let me in. 3. Does my unrequited love for words render you silent? Or does your silence render my love for words unrequited? All I know is when the words come in my torrent of loneliness, you are left looking silly, helpless as any man, desperately clutching an umbrella under a volcano. 4. 6 years ago, I lifted our daughter high under a December night sky until her small heart filled up with words of longing. Oh, hold you, moon. Wordless lexicons opened up inside me, and I felt held in that moment. Is this your language, and will you teach me? Never mind, love. Don't speak. Just hold me like that.
This is Talking Writing on Scenic Roots. My guest is Rachel Landrum Crumble, a noted poet, as well as a teacher and a parent.
Another layer for that for me was being raising biracial children. My husband's black in the 80s and 90s here in Chattanooga in the South. And my husband and I are transplanted Yankees. We've lived here longer than anywhere, so it's home to us. But at the same time, we're always aware that we're outsiders. But in a way, I'm really thankful that we raised them here, because what I said to them when they were younger is that, like, evil has a real face. Like, it's not an institution here. It's like somebody calling you the N-word. And it's like, oh, yeah, there it is. But it tends to be more institutionalized in the North and in other places in the country, where it's like you can't quite touch us, but it's like, oh, I know that. That's ugly. Okay, I can deal with the ugly because I can speak back to it and I can remember who I am. And so sort of coming from a place of with our children, and we had this conversation a lot from the time they were really little on up, was – you are first ours. Well, first God created you, so you're precious and valuable. Then you're ours, though you're precious and valuable. Then you're each one of us, so you're part of me, so you have, and of course, race is a construct, so, but, you know, you can be proud of who you are with me, that you're, you know, you're biracial, you're black and you're white, and different friends of mine even have raised their kids differently with this. But I said, but the culture will look at you and say you're black, and you should embrace that because that's precious. And, you know, talking with them a lot about black history and helping them to embrace that part of who they are, so that they're not like, oh, I'm not that. Yeah, you are, but, and people think only in those binary terms. Not so much today. I think people understand a little bit more about multiracial.
You're around teenagers a lot. And that's my impression too, that this generation seems to be more open-minded than any generation I've seen previously.
I feel like that what's happened is that they've forgotten history, which is even scarier, because I see that they don't know the stories. That they're not, even though they're maybe a generation removed from the stories about how hard won their, you know, certain freedoms are, that they don't know the stories, and so they don't appreciate maybe even their own backgrounds. Mm-hmm. African American students, I teach some of them, or mm-hmm. or what it takes, you know, that why as a white kid shouldn't you use the N-word with a friend? Just because it's on a rap song. Mm. Like, just because if they call each other that, they've won the right to do that. That's for them. It's not for you. And, you know, they don't understand appropriation or any of that.
You've written about this a lot, Rachel.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Would you mm-hmm. care to read one of your poems?
Oh.
Sure. Black Friday is one that I'll go ahead and read that. It was in an anthology called Carrying the Branch, Poets in Search of Peace. In 2017, and Emily Dickinson was a poet who in high school I found, and it was like, oh my gosh, mm-hmm. like, she's my my sister from another era. She had the language, she found the language for things. And there's a poem called There's a Certain Slant of Light, Winter Afternoons, that mm-hmm. carries like the heft mm-hmm. of cathedral tunes, mm-hmm. heavenly hurt. It brings us, we can find no scars, but internal difference where the meanings are, none may teach it any, is the seal despair, imperial affliction sent us from the air, none may, I can't remember the rest of it, all of it, but anyway, I'm taking, like, I have these Roman numeral parts that just take up a portion of some different lines from that poem. It's called Black Friday. One, there's a certain slant of light. Late afternoon squints through the west windows. I am content with leftovers and quiet, my male child accounted for and sleeping, safely home. Two, heavenly hurt it gives us. A distant dog barks without conviction. Traffic swooshes steadily two blocks away. The last of the gold and scarlet leaves tumble from the trees. Protesters in Chicago carry this message down the magnificent mile. Justice is the public face of love. 16 shots and Laquan McDonald's 17-year-old life folded like a knife. Three, none may teach it any. A ladybug crawls across the screen, unfolds wings, flies off. My synapses still smarting from the 2 a.m. phone call. Felony charge, detention hearing. 2 weeks ago, I told my son, be careful who you get in a car with. It could cost you your very life. Four, when it comes, the landscape listens. Today, in Chicago, Paris, and Chattanooga, shadows held their breath, mourning senseless violence. Seven shootings in 3 days in my city alone. The youngest to die in the Paris attacks was 17. My son is just that age today. I exhale. There are reasons why the heart is convalescent.
many reasons if you were to read your other poetry, and it's not as if it comes as news to any of us.
Right.
That the zeitgeist at the moment seems to be so fractured.
Yes.
And fraught.
Yeah.
You know. And you talked about race being a construct. Gender is equally a construct.
Okay. Mm-hmm.
And you are wrestling with that one all the time. And that also seems to be something that's being challenged. A lot of the assumptions that we had about gender and how you treat people.
Yeah.
For you, Rachel, it's a double whammy, you, on top of which you have a daughter.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
One of her parents is black.
Yeah, yeah. And she lives in California, and she says that race rarely comes up because what the brown people treat them like their own, whoever they are, and they own her, and she looks like she could be this or she could be that, and she kind of, you know, but she embraces who she is as a, you know, when she was at GPS, she helped start a club, a sort of a unity club kind of thing.
Forgive me if this is too personal, but
no,
but your work is personal.
Yeah.
When you met Jim,
mm-hmm.
and you both decided to marry,
mm-hmm.
neither one of you are naive. You understood.
Right.
When
we were just kind of like buddies hanging out, we went to Cloudland Canyon. I guess we were a little more than buddies, but we weren't like, yeah, we wouldn't have considered that we were dating. We went to Cloudland Canyon and we got run out. Two white guys came up, young white guys, and they wouldn't even look at Jim or address him, which I found so weird. They just looked at me and said, "Mind if I ask you something?" And I said, "What?" And they said, "Ask you to leave." And I'm like, "Why? We're at a state park." In fact, we're sitting there with a Bible open on the picnic table. And I'm like, "Dude, you know, we're not hurting anybody." I said, "Why?" And he said, "Because you're here with a black man and he's here with a white woman. And if you were here with a white man and he was here with a black woman, that would be okay. But we don't allow this kind of stuff on our mountain. And two men just went to get shotguns and you better leave and take the same roads you came by." So we left because there were no rangers or anything around. And I was so upset. And it was funny when I compared notes with my husband later, when he was my husband,
mm-hmm.
He said he was angry that he was even dating or sort of talking to a white woman again, because he said he would never do that again. So his was like, "Why am I putting myself in this space again?" And me, I was just feeling what that's like for the first time, you know, to feel threatened.
I'm assuming that wasn't the first time that somebody had made some kind of overtures to him like that.
Well,
but was it the first time that he'd had a relationship with a white person?
No. In fact, when he was in college, we would just hang out. I was a student here at UTC, in fact, when we started hanging out. And I was used to hanging out with guys as friends, so it was not a big deal, except that he kept calling me. So I was like, "What is this?" But we were at Yellow Deli, which is back in town and used to be a long time ago. And he said to me when we were there, "What would your father do if he walked in right now?" And I said, "He'd be fine. He dated a black woman in the 70s after my parents divorced. They lived in Columbia, Maryland, which is fairly progressive. But even then, they caught hell for that." So I said, "He'd be fine." I said, "What about yours?" And he said, "He is deathly afraid I'm going to marry a white woman because my two best friends did. But I'm never dating a white woman again because when I did in college, her parents threatened to pull her out of school if she didn't break up with me." And I really wasn't offended because at that point I wasn't romantically attracted to him. I was like, "Oh, okay, no." So
in other words, at that point, he was saying, you know, "There's a line and I'm not going to cross it. We can be friends,
right?
But I don't want to get any more involved."
And I was fine with that. But then he kept asking. Mm-hmm. Then one time he was stuttering about asking me out, and I'm like, "Oh, you really asking me on a date?" And he was like, "I need to talk to you. I've been praying about this." And I'm like, "Ooh." And
what about you? What was your feeling about it?
I tend to kind of process when things are in front of my face in terms of that sort of thing. And I wasn't like attracted to him, but it didn't bother me at all to like hang out with him. And I didn't think there was anything wrong with dating interracially either, but when he said, would you be willing to pursue a dating relationship with me? And he had prayed about it for days and wrestled with it, and me knowing what the cost of that had been for him in the past, I trusted him, and I trusted his walk with God enough to go, okay. And then the feelings came. Yeah. That's kind of how it went. Yeah. But I have another love poem about that, sort of summing up that love relationship. It's called In Praise of Detours, and this was published in the Porterhouse Review last year. In Praise of Detours, at the starting line of my white suburban guilt, I first foresaw a tweety, liberal, blue blood in my future, a family friend, then, God forbid, a disheveled manic angel. I was on my way to an addiction to unstable men who would disappoint me, fair-haired, blue-eyed progeny, a divorce. But traffic was heavy. I was impatient and took a detour. You were on your way to winning a black trophy wife to please your father, who always disappointed you. You were this quirky drummer with a blowout fro and a laugh and a stutter. You never wanted to date a white woman again, and I didn't care. I thought you were sent on some mission of rescue by a mutual friend. Not sure what you saw, but you couldn't leave me alone. You called me from the phone in my dorm lobby and took your time asking me out. 35 years later, our three children have your heart-shaped face and my smile, conceived in the laughter we share. Tonight, I arrive here knowing I have loved you more than half my life, and that more than this house, you are my home.
Rachel Landrum Crumble, my guest this afternoon on Talking Writing. This is Scenic Roots on WUTC.
I'm Ray Bassett. Thanks for listening to Scenic Roots. We come to you from WUTC at the University of Tennessee at Chattanooga. Thanks, as always, to our producers, Haley Solomon, Carly Dodson, Elena Nurabadi, Connor Brown, and Will Davis. Email us at scenicroots423@gmail.com. Follow us on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter at scenicroots423. Listen to us online anytime at WUTC.org and the WUTC app. For Richard Winham and the rest of our team, join us again next time for Scenic Roots.